Future of Medicine under the Affordable Care Act with Dr. C.L. Gray. Just wanted to let everyone know that at the end of the presentation, if you have questions, I believe that the proper way to do that is to push star 2, and that will allow you to ask questions. So anyway, let me introduce our guests for the evening. Tonight, our webcast will be joined by Dr. C.L. Gray, and he will discuss what you as med students can expect under the new healthcare law and what to prepare for as you chart your course as a physician. Dr. Gray is a nationally known writer, speaker, and board-certified physician. Dr. Gray is nationally known also on the speaking circuit. He is he's a board-certified physician practicing hospital-based medicine in North Carolina. In 2006, he founded Physicians for Reform, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the preserving patient-centered healthcare. Now, in its second printing, Dr. Gray's book, The Battle of America's Soul, resulted from a decade spent in research and analysis of the history and philosophy of medical ethics. This book presents findings that link America's present cultural divide with the practice of post-Hippocratic medicine. So anyway, thank you so much, Dr. Gray, for joining us tonight. I'm going to turn it over to you.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you all for joining us for the evening. The presentation will be about 35, 40 minutes, and there will be time for Q&A at the end. One of the biggest things that I feel has been overlooked is just a discussion of what this whole healthcare debate really means, where we're headed, how we got here. And sadly, so much of this has been passed so fast that the country has never really had an honest discussion about what the choices for the future of medicine are. And in order to sort of understand the future, what I'm going to do to begin with is to go back and look at the past. And just a brief background on my travels so far. I actually started this work back when I was doing my medical residency in upstate New York at Cooperstown Bassett Hospital. I was preparing for the grand rounds I had to give at the end of residency, and I was choosing to rebut Peter Singer. Many of you probably know who that is, as the chair of bioethics at Princeton. In the mid-1990s, he had written a book, Rethinking Life and Death. And in that book, he advocates changing the definition of human life to deal with the rising cost of healthcare, so that humans aren't, quote, fully human at birth. They don't become fully human until the fifth week of age. And he introduces the concept of infanticide. Well, I was giving a presentation to a fairly far left-to-center group. And what I chose to do is, instead of saying Peter Singer's wrong, I start with the question, how did America reach a place in her history where a leading bioethicist could seriously propose infanticide, which was actually what he was doing, to deal with the rising cost of health care? So to answer that question, I went back and read some 50 or 60,000 pages of history and philosophy. Yeah, I apologize. I picked up a cold when I was speaking in Ohio, and I still haven't shaken it. But what I found over the course of the last 2,500 years is there's really been two ways to look at healthcare, two ways to look at what it means to be a physician, and by extension, two ways to look at what it means to be a patient. Once you understand this flow of thought, essentially, once you understand these worldviews that sort of govern decision making, it's easier to see what's going to happen with the future of medicine. I actually gave this first talk, and that's part of what I'm going to go through tonight, back in 1999. And of course, that was long before we had started to debate healthcare as a nation. So I'll run through that quickly, and then we can take some Q&A at the end. Several of you may have heard the story of Barbara Wagner, and she was a 64-year-old gal that lived in the state of Oregon and didn't have health insurance. And Oregon, like every other state, was trying to decide what to do with the rising number of uninsured. So they came up with this program, the Oregon Health Plan. And at age 64, Barbara developed recurrent lung cancer, went and saw her oncologist, and was prescribed Tarceva. At that time, it was a new chemotherapy. But she went to get the medication. Actually, she couldn't get the medication. Instead, she got a letter from the state of Oregon saying they would not pay for chemotherapy. It was a state-run program. But they would either pay for hospice or for physician-assisted suicide. See, Barbara's situation is she had sort of become a negative economic unit in the state of Oregon, had run out of money. And they had to start making decisions who was going to get what kind of care. And essentially, government compassion sounds so noble, but in the end, whoever pays holds the power to choose. And as I listen to this story, it reminded me of the book Rethinking Life and Death, written by Peter Singer, where he decides not to consider humans fully human until the fifth week of age. And if an infant is born with a severe disability, the choice could be made to have them killed or put to sleep. And so that the money that would have been used on treating the infant with a severe disability instead could be invested in a child that was more gifted. And he argues this makes for a more effective and efficient practice of medicine. So what I see in these two stories is a rather common theme of sorting patients out between who's contributing to society and who's a quote, burden on society. So in my reading, I went back trying to see where these ideas come from. It actually starts back in ancient Greece, and that's sort of where our story begins with the thinkers of Plato and Hippocrates. Well, in Plato's Republic, he actually addresses the role of the ideal physician. He says, quote, "But bodies that disease has penetrated through and through, the physician would not have attempted to cure. He, being the physician, did not want to lengthen out good-for-nothing lives or to have weak fathers begetting weaker sons." He goes on, "If a man was not able to live in the ordinary way, he, being a physician, had no business to cure the patient. For such a cure would have been no use either to himself or to the state." And in those last four words, I have to think this is one of the first examples of statism, where we start to look at what's good for the collective, what's good for the state, not necessarily what's in the best interest or the well-being of the individual patient. Plato continues, "These practices will treat the bodies and minds of your citizens who are naturally well endowed. As for the rest, those with poor physical constitution will be allowed to die. And those with irredeemably rotten minds," you sort of have to appreciate the poetry of Plato, "but those with irredeemably rotten minds will be put to death." Here we see sort of one pole of an ethical compass where Plato is seriously suggesting that the physician's role in society is to separate those that are moving the greater good forward, moving society forward, as opposed to those who are a burden on society. So under Plato's sort of thinking, we start to look at people differently based on their contribution to society. Well, one of Plato's contemporaries is Hippocrates. Hippocrates is born about 460 B.C. Plato was born about 427, some sources say 429 B.C. So they're about 30 years apart. But Hippocrates sort of defines another pole for this ethical compass. He says in On Breath, quote, "The physician sees terrible things and touches on the loathsome, and from others' misfortunes harvests troubles of his own." So here we see an element of compassion, of humanity in the role of the physician. In his oath, he says, "I'll not give a poison to anyone who has to do so, nor will I suggest such a plan. In the same way, I'll not give a pessary to a woman to cause an abortion, but in purity and in holiness, I will guard my life and my heart." So the question comes up, why would he put that first line in there? "I will not give a poison to anyone who has to do so, nor will I suggest such a plan." Well, in ancient Greece, much as we do today, except to a much greater degree, they struggled with pain control. And there would be some patients with this unrelenting pain from a fracture or a cancer or a slipped disc or something, where they'd actually go to their physician and say, Doc, I can't get rid of this pain. Please let me take something to take my life just so I can escape it. And even in this setting of unrelenting pain, Hippocrates says, I will not give a poison to anyone who has to do so, nor will I suggest such a plan. So then the question comes is why? Why would Hippocrates say that? And it turns out that Hippocrates was a Pythagorean, taking after the school of thought of Pythagoras, who we normally think of as a mathematician with Pythagorean theorem, a squared plus b squared equals c squared. But he was also a philosopher, and at the base of Pythagorean philosophy was the concept of human life was special, that human life was a gift from the gods, is supposed to be held and defended. So for a physician to even help a patient take their own life was a violation of the sacred trust, of this higher moral code. So Hippocrates was saying, because I believe human life is special, that I won't help them or help a patient take their own life, even in the setting of unrelenting pain. And you can sort of see this in the last line there, but in purity and in holiness I will guard my life and my art. It has this religious sort of overtone to it. It was based on his worldview. In precepts, we see this reflected in a statement, for if love of men is present, love of the art is also present. So here we see sort of this outline of this ethical compass with Plato and Hippocrates. Instead of a north and a south, we see an H and a P. Well, as it turns out that most of ancient Greek thought and culture sort of fit with the worldview of Plato. But over the next 300 years or so, this needle swings from a P over towards H, sort of driven by free market forces. You can imagine a patient that's getting up in age and, you know, their knees hurt and their hips hurt and their back hurts and their neck hurts. And they have to choose to go see a physician. Which physician are they going to choose? Well, naturally, they're going to choose the Hippocratic physician that treats individuals as individuals. They're not prejudging patients on who's going to be of most benefit to the state. So this needle swings over towards H, and it stays there for about 2,000 years. And here we see, in the mid-14th century, a Christianized version of the Hippocratic Oath. And it sort of makes sense, because under Christian theology, we see a thought form that fits very closely to Pythagorean philosophy. After St. Augustine with Imago Dei, the image of God, that human life is special. So it sort of makes sense for the growing Christian West to adopt the Hippocratic ideals and transform them to Christian theology. So the needle stays here up until the end of the late 1800s, when we see the writings of Friedrich Nietzsche, and here he specifically addresses the physician. And you think back of sort of the famous phrase from Nietzsche, God is dead. And once Nietzsche destroys God, he starts to look to set out his own moral code. And he does so in Twilight of the Idols for Physicians. In section 36, he writes a moral code for physicians. And as we read through Nietzsche, listen for patterns in thought. He says, quote, the invalid is a parasite on society. In a certain state, it is indecent to go on living, to vegetate on and cowardly dependence on physicians and medications after the meaning of life, even the right to life, has been lost. This ought to entail the profound contempt of society. Nietzsche continues, physicians, in their turn, ought to be the communicators of contempt, not prescriptions, but every day a fresh dose of disgust for their patients. It's interesting here, we see physicians ought to be communicators of contempt, which is very different than the way we view the role of the physician in America today. Nietzsche continues, he says, to create a new responsibility, that of the physician, in all cases in which the highest interest of life or the ascending of life, and when you read Nietzsche, the ascending life is the young, the strong, the fit, those that are moving society forward. Nietzsche goes on, this demands the most ruthless suppression, sequestration of degenerating life. And you can see in the writings of Nietzsche, degenerating life is those that are a burden on society. The infirm, the weak, the elderly. He says, for example, this ought to be sort of taken into consideration in determining the right to reproduce, the right to be born, in fact, even the right to live. So we see in this ethical compass where the needle had swung over towards H, it's now pointing back towards P at the end of the 1800s. And following the writings of Nietzsche, we see the rise of the Third Reich. And part of this, we see medical atrocities under Nazi Germany, and where physicians participated in these experiments. And the picture here we have is one of the Dachau hypothermia experiments, where they would be done supposedly to learn how to rewarm down pilots suffering from hypothermia. So they would take their subject or their victim, immerse them in vats of ice water, nearly freeze them to death, and then rewarm them using various methods. Sometimes they put them under scalding lamps and burn their skin, or put tubes down through their esophagus and pour in hot water and scald their stomachs, or up through the rectum and scald their colon, or open their abdominal cavity and pour in scalding water, or drop them in vats of hot oil. And if a subject was to survive, they'd be nearly refrozen and put through the torture again. So here we see the needle had swung back towards P, but following World War II, part of the Geneva Convention tried explicitly to re-anchor medicine to its Hippocratic roots. But what we've seen in the last 50, 60 years has been a swing of this needle back away from H. And we'll briefly walk through that process. In 1949, was the first sort of reversal of Hippocratic ideals, and that the Geneva Convention didn't include an oath. It was a pledge with a list of standards open to revision. You think about an oath, and it's just that. It's a swearing before one's God or gods to uphold a certain set of ideals for all time. But without an oath, this list of standards was revised. In 1960, the World Medical Association actually alters the wording of the Geneva Convention, changing the definition of human life. Instead of it being sacred from conception, and now it's sacred from the beginning. And we see the entrance of postmodern thought, where we can start to debate and argue about when the beginning of human life actually is. In 1973, abortion is legalized here in the U.S. 1985, Peter Singer writes a book called Should the Baby Live? And we're listening for patterns and thought. He says, quote, we think that some infants with severe disabilities should be killed. This recommendation may cause particular offense to readers who were themselves born with disabilities, perhaps even the same disabilities that we're discussing. So there are people that are reading his books, attending his lectures, that are able to argue with him intellectually. And he says perhaps even they shouldn't have been allowed to live. 1994, the book Rethinking Life and Death that we started with. He says, quote, we suggest a period of 28 days after birth that might be allowed before the infant is accepted as having the same right to life as others. This is clearly before the infant could have a sense of its own existence over time and allow a couple to decide that it is better not to continue with a life that has begun very badly. Sort of reminds you of lives that are not worth living. And the needle continues to swing. 1997, physician-assisted suicide is legalized in Oregon. 1999, Princeton University appoints Peter Singer to the R.W. DeKalb Chair of Bioethics. I actually gave this first lecture about 2 months after that appointment. So my engagement with the flow of history and philosophy and the future of medicine predated Barack Obama, predated President Bush, and really had nothing to do with the Clintons. So for me, this really isn't primarily a political engagement. This is just about what happens to culture as you shift world views. 2008, the Oregon Health Plan refuses Barbara Wagner chemotherapy, but instead offers to pay for physician-assisted suicide. January 31st, 2009, the National Institute of Health Director of Bioethics wrote a paper for The Lancet, and he introduces the concept of something he calls the complete live system. He says, quote, consideration of the importance of the complete live system also supports modifying the youngest first principle by prioritizing adolescents and young adults over infants. So when I do my public speaking, I ask the audience, well, what is the youngest first principle? And it's actually sort of part of our DNA here in the West. We value, you know, the youngest of our culture. We see this reflected in if a house is burning, what do we say? You know, make sure the kids are out of the bedroom. You know, if a ship is going down, what do we say? Get the women and the children off board. And we've always valued our youth because the future of a nation lies in the minds of our youth. So there's something very special about kids. But he says we need to start to modify this youngest first principle and prioritize adolescents and young adults over infants. Now the question becomes, why? He goes on to argue, adolescents have received substantial education and parental care, investments that will be wasted without a complete life. Infants, by contrast, have not yet received these investments. So he's saying we've already spent a lot of time, energy, money, parental care, education, to get these infants into late adolescence and into their 20s. And interestingly enough, this is when they start to produce for society, where he says, infants, we really haven't invested much in. He goes on, when implemented, the complete law system also produces a priority curve on which the individuals between the ages of 15 and 45 years of age get the most substantial chance. And here I'll just take a little time out. The most substantial chance of what? Well, if you go back and read that paper, he's dealing with actually a good and very difficult question about what to do with medical procedures in an age of scarce resources. So if we don't have enough resources to sort of do everything for everyone, and we're certainly at a place where we're having to start to ask that, he says, how do we start to allocate those resources? So he introduces the complete live system. He said this produces a priority curve on which individuals between the ages 15 and 40 get the most substantial chance of a medical procedure in an age of scarce resources, whereas the youngest and the oldest people, well, they get chances that are somewhat attenuated. He goes on. Unlike allocation by sex or race, allocation by age, he argues, is not discrimination. Treating 65-year-olds differently because of stereotypes, now that would be ageist, but treating them differently because they have already had more life years is not. So he's suggesting we can start to look at how we allocate medical resources based on age. And this next slide is taken directly out of his paper. On the left, we see the probability of receiving an intervention. The bottom, of course, is age and years. So as I look at this, I see the thinking of Plato. I see the thinking of Peter Singer, of Friedrich Nietzsche. Where at the left was Singer, you know, we think of an infant born with a disability. Well, if they need a procedure and they're not contributing to society, well, they have a relatively low chance of receiving that procedure. Whereas on the right, we see the story of Barbara Wagner, whereas they're getting up in age, and if they're needing some sort of expensive procedure, we start to withhold that. And it also fits a who's producing for culture. Well, it's between the ages of 15 and 55. And usually my presentation, the name and position isn't on the bottom, but the animation isn't working on the slide set. But this is Ezekiel Emanuel, and you'll recognize that name as brother of Rahm Emanuel, former White House Chief of Staff. And Ezekiel Emanuel is actually White House Healthcare Policy Advisor for the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. So we start to see this philosophy that I was concerned about back in 1999 when I gave this first talk, this worldview that starts to sort patients out and discriminate based on who's producing for society and who's a burden on society. So why concern ourselves with history and philosophy? Well, it's because worldviews find their way into the public policy. Those that we elect and send to Washington, or state governments for that matter, carry with them a worldview, and that worldview is reflected in the legislation they write and pass. And if you remember the date on Ezekiel Emanuel's paper in the Lancet for the Complete Live System of January 31st, 2009, here we are about 2.5 weeks later with transfer of power being passed in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And it created something called the Federal Coordinating Council for Comparative Effectiveness Research. It was very well funded, $1 billion, and had a 15-member panel, which was appointed almost immediately. And then the Affordable Care Act goes on to expand this. So in those words, are comparative effectiveness research. And certainly my medical training, we were looking at comparative effectiveness research and going back in the literature and saying, well, what's actually effective? You know, the phrase that we used a lot then was evidence-based medicine. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with comparing things or finding out what's effective or what has evidence behind it. And we certainly want to base that on research. But this starts to mean something else when they're writing this legislation. We will see that in just a bit. The same legislation also established something called a National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. And it makes us think of the new electronic medical record. And part of this legislation said, quote, it's to determine treatment at the time and place of care, and that physicians and hospitals that are not meaningful users of the system over time will face penalties. So this is setting up a mechanism, especially through the new medical record, where they're able to start to assess physician medical decision making and be able to start to punish physicians and hospitals that are considered meaningful users of the system. So we see this developed in much more detail in the Affordable Care Act itself. Now, I'm only going to cover a couple of sections in the interest of time. But Section 3007 established something called a value-based payment modifier. And here it says, quote, the secretary shall establish a payment modifier that provides for a differential payment to a physician or group of physicians based on quality of care furnished compared to cost. And usually I don't have the second quote up there, and we'll get to that part in just a second. But backing up to actually look at this, let's see what that really means. The first four words sort of scare me to death. The secretary shall establish. This is an unelected, unaccountable individual that's starting to establish something called a payment modifier. Well, what's a payment modifier? It means to start to withhold some Medicare reimbursement to physicians and hospitals. That's what the differential payment means. to a physician or group of physicians, also includes hospitals, based on what the quality of care furnished compared to cost. And that's where comparative effectiveness research left out a word. What they really mean is comparative cost effectiveness research, where they start to define things based on cost and outcomes. And in fact, this goes on to say, quote, the term cost means expenditures per individual as what? Determined appropriate by the secretary. So the secretary gets to define how much cost we are allowed to incur per individual. And if a physician is ordering more than that, or in a hospital setting, there's cost overruns, the secretary can actually reduce the reimbursement to that physician or hospital. And this is essentially threatening the livelihood of a practicing physician, which gives the secretary extraordinary power. This is actually a copy of the two pages of Section 3007, and it's a little small, probably on your screen, but the section I've read in 21 times. There's a transfer of power to the Secretary of Health and Service. This the sections in red that say the Secretary shall establish, as established by the Secretary shall establish, as determined appropriate by the Secretary, established by the Secretary, determined appropriate by the Secretary shall specify, and time and time and time again, it says the Secretary shall. Really, what the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act does isn't so much lay out what's going to happen to reform the U.S. healthcare system, is it transfers power to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and that is where the true guidelines are coming for what's going to really impact how we practice medicine. And that's where actually the Catholic Church ran afoul. With the government, there's one of these lines talked about the secretary shall establish a preventative care for women. And of course, we all want women to have preventative care. But she also included in that contraception and access to birth control and sort of mandated that the Catholic Church be subject to that, violating their strongly held beliefs. So that's really what the legislation does, is transfers power to government and gives the Secretary of Health and Human Services power over medical decision making. Second piece of the bill, and this is something you've probably heard about, the apologize for the cough, the IPAB, the Independent Payment Advisory Boards, comes from Section 3403. Looking at this, it's, quote, purpose. It is the purpose of this section to reduce the per capita rate of growth of Medicare spending. So it's specifically tasked to reduce Medicare spending. It has 15 presidentially appointed independent experts. It gains authority to cap Medicare spending in 2015. But it's this last bullet that really concerns me. The IPAB's recommendations become law unless overridden by 2/3 majority votes in the Senate and 2 majority votes in the House. So what's going on with that piece? Normally an advisory board gives advice to Congress. If it's hopefully good advice, it's incorporated into legislation. Then, of course, to become law, it needs to pass the House with a majority vote, pass the Senate, 3/5 majority to overcome the filibuster. And then it needs a signature by the president to become law. This sort of stands that process on its head. Essentially, the IPAB gets to write law unless it's stopped by the House or the Senate. And why 2 votes? And this is where it gets more interesting. The first vote, they can simply vote it down. If it's an absolutely terrible idea, think of no chemotherapy for anybody over 65. You can certainly imagine you'd have virtually every vote in both parties, House and Senate, voting against it. Well, that recommendation still becomes law unless the House and the Senate pass cuts of equal or greater value. And that's where it gets tough, because there's no way you're going to get a 3/5 majority of votes in the Senate to make a cut to Medicare greater than that of the cut that the IPAP recommend it. So it gives Congress essentially plausible deniability, where they can come home and say they voted against that recommendation, knowing full well it'll still become law. And this was thought to be a good idea because those that were sort of behind the concept of the IPAB, or an independent ruling board, their argument was, well, we can't trust Congress to control spending because they'll just never do it when they have to face the voters. So let's place this power in the hands of 15 people who don't have to face the voters. That's the logic behind it. Essentially, turning in them into a completely independent board in the worst sense of the word. This almost makes me think, yeah, I can't believe this is happening in America. You know, that's the kind of ruling technique I'd expect from Stalinist Russia. But that's now the law of the land. So it takes us back to Ezekiel Emanuel's complete live system. And this slide is a little bit old. It's now at $16.2 trillion for the U.S. debt. And you look at that and you think, how are we going to control Medicare spending when we're well over $16 trillion in debt? And that's there at the right end and the left end of that curve, with a fundamental change in how we view patients. So we start to look at them in terms of, are they going to benefit society or are they going to burden society? Not in terms of the innate dignity of human life. And just looking at the national debt, when that paper was written, the national debt stood at $10.6 trillion. That debt is now about $16.2 trillion. Interest rates are at sort of historic lows, about 2.25%. Meaning we spend somewhere around $240 billion a year on interest, but when those rates rise to sort of their historic norms of 5 to 6%, we're spending $500 to $600 billion a year just on interest. In 2010, we spent just north of $500 billion on Medicare and just north of $400 billion on Medicaid. So we're looking at soon reaching a place where we're paying more just to serve interest on the debt than either Medicare or Medicaid. And this was a chart released actually a year ago now, where the total combined debt of Europe on the left in blue was less than the debt of the U.S. And if you look at a per capita basis, the average American holds more debt than the average European in terms of national debt. So what's happening is the government's running out of money. They're starting to really squeeze physicians. And I can tell an enormous difference in the practice of medicine now than as opposed to when I finished residency 13 years ago. And there's a fairly large poll done, looking at about 5,000 physicians, asking likely to retire in the next 5 years because of the legislation. About 23% said they're very likely to retire, and another 19 said likely. So we're looking at a place where about 40% of physicians are saying, boy, I just want to leave. And then the question was asked, are you willing to recommend healthcare or medicine as a profession to go into? And 9 out of 10 docs are saying don't do it, which is very sad, especially for those of you on this call who are in the process of putting in incredible hours to become physicians. So the question then is there another way forward? And I'm going to go through this very, very quickly because we're almost out of time. But the answer is yes. I was actually asked by a friend of one of the presidential contenders last fall to write an alternative plan if the Affordable Care Act was to be overturned. And this is available on the website, physiciansforreform.org. It's a paper I wrote called Cutting the Gordian Knot, a patient-centered, fiscally responsible plan for healthcare reform. And there actually is a way to start to solve this problem, to fix the system, to where we can put the patient and the physician back at the center of healthcare. One very, very brief example of one idea. I list five guiding principles and 17 ideas, specific reforms that we can undertake. But one of them is getting back to where we can, sort of a direct patient pay model. And this can be accomplished using HSAs with lower cost, higher deductible plans. So we still have the insurance because medical costs now are so high, we have to have some form of insurance, but get the patients to control their own dollar more. And with this model of direct patient pay, we can cut out enormous amounts of inefficiency in the system. I was giving a town hall a year and a half ago in Raleigh, North Carolina, and one of the physicians on the panel I was moderating was a family practice physician. When he finished his medical training, he said, you know, this is a crazy system. So I'm going to not take Medicare, Medicaid, or insurance. I'm just going to go out and hang a shingle and have my prices posted on the door, and they can pay cash when they come in. So an office visit might be $40, a lab test might be $20 or $65, depending on what the lab was. And as it turns out, he has done remarkably well. The average family practice physician hires between 4 and 5 people per physician to run the office because of all the paperwork. He's able to hire about 3 physicians for every 1 staff. The average family practice physician collects about 65% of what they bill, use about 60% of it to pay for overhead. And because they're always having to fight with Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance to be reimbursed, whereas he collects essentially 100% of what he bills because it's fee for service at the door, relatively low numbers, but he always gets paid, and he spends about 25% of that on overhead. So essentially he's tripled his efficiency, so he actually spends more time with patients. He enjoys his job more. His patients enjoy seeing him, and because he spends more time with patients, he has better patient outcomes for less money. So there's ways to start to increase the efficiency of the system and achieve better outcomes. Sorry, and achieve better outcomes while at the same time reducing cost. In the history and philosophy that I was talking to you about, I've outlined in the book The Battle for America's Soul, where the first 3 chapters talk about this background of medicine. In the center section, chapters 4 to 13 talk about the culture war, why the left sometimes has this almost visceral hatred of the right. A lot of times the right simply doesn't understand the left, and where that comes from, where these worldviews are, how they developed. And then the last 4 chapters, I show the same process that's driving healthcare is driving education and foreign policy and the court system and postmodern politics. And then there's a movie that was just released. It's actually a documentary based on the book and my public speaking. And it's actually available online for free. You can just go to YouTube and search for The Determinators Movie, and you can watch. It's a 58-minute documentary that's recently been released that goes through this in a little different fashion than we went through it tonight. It's more of a movie setting rather than just a slideshow with a voice. But that's available online to watch, that sort of goes through this and has several other healthcare experts from around the country to weigh in. One of the reasons I started Physicians for Reform, and this is, I believe, the last slide, is that patients still trust physicians. There's a survey that was done a couple of years ago now, but asked, who do you trust in the question of healthcare reform? Physicians, working physicians, are way over there at the left at 73%. Clearly a bipartisan support for working physicians and what they think about healthcare. And then as you get into the non-physician and political class, that support drops off. So I started Physicians for Reform to collect the best ideas and to get physician leadership along with patients and business owners to start to craft ideas to fix the U.S. healthcare system. So the website of my nonprofit is physiciansforreform.org. And if you go there, And I think it's for a donation of $25. You can order a book, The Battle for America's Soul, and we'll throw in a complimentary copy of the movie, The Determinators, if anybody wants to do that. And that's at physiciansforreform.org. Well, I see I'm right at about 45 minutes, so I'll quit there. And I start call at 10 Eastern Standard Time, so I have about 15 minutes for Q&A. Oh, John, are you there?
Doctor?
Yes.
Okay. What are the biggest changes coming in the field of healthcare to be aware of, and what are the best and worst things about these changes? And that is in regards to a new student coming into medical school.
Well, the biggest change I see is really a fundamental transformation of what it means to be a physician. And what we're seeing is it used to be back when I was in training, I'd come out, physicians generally were working for themselves and for their patients. I've seen a tremendous number of physicians be moved out of private practice, family practice, internal medicine, cardiology. There's a wave going through the country now of cardiology practices essentially closing their doors as private groups and starting to work for hospitals. In fact, Mile Group was a private group of hospitalists. And then Medicare reimbursement fell so far we couldn't stay viable financially. So we went out of practice, and now I'm a hospital employee. So that's one of the biggest trends. A lot of hospitals are great. The hospital administrators are great. I work for a great hospital. And I haven't ever been told to do or not to do something that was outside of my medical judgment. But that fundamentally changes how a physician is compelled to think. When it's you and the patient, you're sitting down thinking through exactly how to best serve them, and you don't have another force kind of working on you. As physicians become employees, first of hospitals, and then they'll become employees of the state, going down the road we're headed down now. That can be reversed. But the system is moving towards where the physicians will become employees of government. And there's discussion now of, instead of state licensing, getting national licensing, where the federal government will then have power, licensing power over physicians, compelling them to behave in a certain manner. More physicians are starting to leave Medicare and Medicaid, especially, less so for the traditional insurance, to start to work out a sort of a direct patient pay model. And I think that's, as a medical student going into school, that's one of the things to sort of keep your ear to the ground on. And depending on what field you want to go into, if you want to go into something like neurosurgery, it's very, very hard to do, essentially impossible, to do a direct patient pay model, you know, because you're essentially, and same for a hospitalist, because there's no way a patient can be responsible for that bill, as opposed to an office visit to see a family practice physician or an internist. It's much easier to use that model in that setting. But that's the thing that I worry about in some ways the most is the physician falling under the compulsion of government, and that's what my nonprofit is trying to get reversed, among other things.
Great. I have one last question here, and then I'll let you get back to your work there. How will the Affordable Act, Care Act, affect conscience rights of physicians?
As long as we still have state licensure, I think there's going to be a limit to how much the feds can force physicians to do. But clearly there's an effort to turn decision-making over to a bureaucracy, to a system, rather than an individual. And the more power that system has, the more it's going to start to interfere with individual conference or conscience clauses. So at the moment,
great.
I'd say it's not a major issue, but I fear that will become a major issue if we continue down this road.
Okay. It is 9:50. Do you have time for one more question?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. The Affordable Care Act seems so large and expansive. Even if it is repealed with a new president, will all of it be repealed?
Yep. Yeah, that's a great question. It's going to be very hard to get this all repealed. One, because there's just technically to get the thing repealed will be difficult. Not impossible. We'll find out more next week, depending on the votes in the Senate and, of course, the presidential race. But it's doable. But as we saw before, there's pieces of legislation passed that are unrelated to the Affordable Care Act. Back even under the stimulus legislation that started to impact healthcare. So to truly get this philosophy repealed is going to take a lot of discipline and determination and willpower for those that want to get it reversed. And from a political perspective, I think the best way to gain the political sort of will on the part of we the people to do that is to provide common sense, fiscally responsible, patient-centered alternatives. And that's what I've tried to do in the paper, Cutting the Gordian Knot, where I lay out an argument that the average person can understand and say to get the patient and the physician back to the center of medical decision-making, we have to choose another road, and it is fixable. So I try and lay out a common sense solution and not just bomb throw. Because if all we do is bomb throw, we're going to push away the centrist voter that we need to engage if we're going to actually get patients and physicians back at the center of healthcare.
Dr. Gray, on behalf of Medical Students for Life, we want to thank you so much for doing this webcast tonight. I know that there are many, many students who very much appreciate your time and giving us so much information, so many things to chew on. I know that we've discussed the possibility of you joining us on our spring tour, med tour, traveling to different universities, and that may be a possibility. And it may have a different approach depending on how the election goes or that doesn't go. So,
yeah,
anyway.
Well, that would be great. And just because I didn't talk about it explicitly, just one last thought. Since you're Med Students for Life, traditionally that's sort of understood to be for the unborn. But philosophically, the unborn, the newly born, and the elderly are inextricably hooked together. So abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia is a trio. And I think we're going to have to restart to think how we look at our arguments, because just the abortion argument by itself, most people just run to their corners and won't listen. But by hooking them together, we still can talk to people about euthanasia, and they'll listen. We can talk to people about infanticide, and they'll listen. And that's really the approach I've taken. I don't spend a lot of time engaging abortion directly, but I find the centrist, thoughtful person, I can have actually a very productive conversation by starting with those other two issues.
Again, thank you so much, Dr. Gray, and thank you all for tuning and listening in online and also via the phone, and have a great evening.
And I wish you all the best.
Take care.
Thanks. Yeah, bye.